Sheffield Live, made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Dawn? You know what, I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3, here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning and welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure, even maybe share them around. We've got Julian Pauly live, as usual, in the studio here on Paternoster Row at the workstation in Sheffield. Later in the show, we'll be talking to RPG. He's got a great track, which we've already sneakily played a bit of on the end of Soul Plus, but that's another story. This week, and indeed every first Saturday of the month, our guest speaker is Phil Muffett, and All Be Well. He'll be talking about the partial eclipse last Saturday and the amazing photographs he and his club managed to get. As, of course, he's a member of the Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society. Next week, and indeed every second Saturday of the month, our guest speaker is Dr. Ogo Osamoh. So All Be Well, he'll be joining us. Before we move on to the first news article of the week, I just want to remind folks that the Sheffield Photographic Society annual exhibition is on at Sheffield Cathedral. It finishes tomorrow, Sunday the 6th of April, so get there while you can. It's open during cathedral opening hours. It's free. There's some fantastic images there. Go and support your local club. And you can also vote for your favourites. And also, the cathedral itself is stunning inside. And the cafe's amazing. So what's not to like?
Plenty of history there.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Next up, quartz kitchen worktop trend is driving a rise in deadly stonemason disease. I saw this article in the press a few weeks ago now, and I thought it was an incredibly interesting one. So from the age of 19, Ryan Fenton worked as a stonemason for nearly three decades. Now he has silicosis, a disease that is often fatal. The fine dust he has inhaled making kitchen workshop tops has caused scarring in his lungs. So modern quartz worktops are the culprits, made of crushed stone, resins and metals reformulated into smooth slabs. The cheaper than marble or granite and far easier to cut into shape. They come in a wide range of colours and finishes and have surged in popularity. But doctors are now warning with increasing urgency that the fashion for quartz worktops poses real danger to the workers who cut the slabs. Some experts are calling for a ban after Australia outlawed engineered stone last year. The first case of silicosis linked to artificial stone was reported in the UK in autumn 2023, so not that long ago. And in August 2024, an influential paper was published in the Thorax Medical Journal listing 8 cases identified in Britain so far. When this article was written, which was a few weeks ago now, doctors had seen 28 cases of silicosis. 2 people had died, with many more deaths predicted. So silicosis is caused by inhaling respirable crystalline silica. That's RCS for short. And that's talking about really small particles of silica which are freshly fractured. Once quartz is installed and polished, it does not pose a danger. But for the stonemasons who cut it, silica dust is a severe hazard. According to the Health and Safety Executive, which is the HSE, silica is the biggest risk to construction workers after asbestos. And I think that's what caught my eye, to be honest. Quartz is a particular problem because it has a silica content as high as 95%. Compared with granite, which has got 30%, and marble, even less at 3%. So when Ryan Fenton started as an apprentice, when he was at 19, he worked mainly on natural stone. But in recent years, he switched almost exclusively to quartz. There's a difference, he said. It's the taste in the air. You can smell it. People might say dust is dust, but this is finer. It's more powdery. You'd see it hanging in the air. It would be in your hair, your boots, your overalls. It would get everywhere. Silicosis can take up to 15 years to develop, although in some patients, they develop severe cases after as little as 3 years of working with artificial stone. And when you first develop it, you have no symptoms. But as it progresses, you have increasing breathlessness, sometimes a cough, and sometimes chest pain. Now, by chance, Ryan Fenton, who has 2 daughters aged 22 and 21, had his condition caught early. And that's because 2 years ago, he had suffered a mini stroke, and a scan revealed unrelated scarring on his lungs. And the team who were treating him diagnosed silicosis. Ryan immediately quit his job. He says, I feel fine at the moment. He sings and plays guitar in 2 cover bands. And he says, maybe it's because I'm exercising my lungs as a singer that's made him, okay. Studies suggest that if exposure is stopped, there is a 50-50 chance whether the disease will progress. He says, I'm trying to get on with my life, but it's always in the back of my mind. And if his condition does progress, there's little doctors can do. A lung transplant is an option for some, while others are put on anti-fibrotics to relieve the symptoms. But there is no cure. Now, a couple of people died last year from silicosis, and Lydia Brown, the senior coroner for West London, who will hear the inquest of one of them, has written a prevention of death report, which is an unusual step before the case has even begun. She said, this is Lydia Brown, who was a senior coroner in West London, said, in my opinion, urgent action should be taken to prevent future deaths. Last month's new guidance for artificial stone workshops was issued by HSC. So that's a story all about quartz kitchen worktop trend driving a rise in deadly stonemason disease, silicosis. When the stonemasons cut that quartz, it's a big risk to their health. But once it's installed and polished, it is not a problem for the general public. A most interesting story.
I want everybody to hear. Please don't fight and fuss and what?
Get off the bloody floor. We'll be right back.
bit of breathless there by Atomic Rooster, because we're talking about silly coasters. Of course, listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. Next up, our environment updates. It's a short one this week.
Yes, voters in Paris have approved a plan to close 500 more roads to cars, expanding on the mayor Anne Hidalgo's efforts to reduce pollution and improve cycling infrastructure. The plan, which received 66% approval, will also remove 10% of Parisian parking spaces. The city's climate plan promises that these spaces will be replaced with trees, building on its goal to establish 300 hectares of new green space by 2030.
Closer to home, the first batch of new trees are being planted in Wissmans Wood, one of the south-west of England's last remaining patches of temperate rainforest. The Duchy of Cornwall, which owns the ancient oak woodland on Dartmoor, announced plans in 2023 to double the size of the site in partnership with Natural England. Last week, volunteers planted 450 oak and rowan saplings grown from seeds gathered from the wood, beginning the process of natural regeneration.
Yes, elsewhere in the news, analysis by a company called Time and the data firm Statista have revealed the world's top green tech companies for 2025, covering areas such as renewable energy, food innovations and battery storage. The battery-powered aircraft maker Beta Technologies came in first, followed by the direct air capture company Climeworks and Appeal Sciences, which is developing a plant-based covering to better preserve the shelf life of fresh produce.
Finally, Chelsea Flower Show is the crowning jewel of the gardening calendar, but it has a dirty secret. Despite years of campaigning by conservation charities, Chelsea, like most of the horticultural industry, relies on peat-grown plants. Peat is a valuable carbon store and vital habitat, and the RHS announced 4 years ago that the Chelsea Flower Show this May would be the last where peat use would be allowed, with a blanket ban for future shows, but the society has now delayed that ban by another 2 years. Boo! And who doesn't like a bit of Genesis saying that? Quiet Earth from 1977. It's a cracker, and we played that because, oh dear, Chelsea Flower Show will not be peat-free for another few years yet, dearie me. You're of course listening to Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. All being well, we should have our PG on the line.
Trying this, I'm trying to live on science alone now.
Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
Oh, sounding bright morning. And clear. You see, some things do work.
Oh, steady.
Steady
I don't
on.
Work often, though.
I know. So what's caught your eye in the science news this week, then, Paul?
Oh, well, a couple of little things, and then a general trend, I guess, is what we'll talk about. But the first thing that caught my eye is about an experiment that was undertaken in Tanzania. And it shows the major impact of diet on the immune system. So what they did is they took a sample of just short of 80 men and got them to switch around the diet. So the typical Western diet and also their own traditional African foods. And they said that switching for just 2 weeks from the traditional African diet to a Western diet causes inflammation, reduces the immune system response to pathogens, and activates processes associated with lifestyle diseases. Conversely, an African-rich diet in vegetables, fiber, and fermented foods has positive effects. This study highlights the significant impact of diet on the immune system and metabolism. So they did this experiment in switching over 2 weeks from the various diets, and it's been published in the journal Nature Medicine. And it just highlights the significant impact of diet on the immune system and our metabolisms. So lifestyle diseases like cardiovascular disease, diabetes and chronic inflammatory conditions are on the surge across Africa at the moment, posing a growing challenge to their healthcare systems. And the increase in economic development, urbanisation and wider availability of processed foods have accelerated the adoption of Western eating habits in Africa. So they undertook this study with, say, just short of 80 men from Tanzania in both urban and rural areas, and they participated in the study. And a third group consumed a fermented banana drink daily as a control to the other two sort of variations. But significantly, it says that immune cells responded less effectively to pathogens on the Western diet, and the people who switched back to the African diet consumed the food with lots of fibre and fermented drinks showed a marked reduction in the inflammatory markers. So some of these effects persisted even 4 weeks later, indicating the short-term dietary changes can have long-lasting effects.
It's so fascinating, yeah.
It's an amazing bit of research and not a place that we look to. So they said, you know, we're often looking at comparing the Mediterranean diet and other diets, but this is sort of a validation for the typical African diet in Tanzania, at least. And I think it is one of those things that a lot of the time people with conditions that are inflammatory-based often will go down the route of different diet and more fresh produce, vegetables and things, so getting more fibre. So that really kind of underlines that change.
Yeah, Chris was on, was it only last week? Or was it, no, it was a week before, was it? No, last week, was last week, because we swapped it around. He's been on, you know, talking about diet and the impact of ultra-processed foods, particularly in areas, less developed countries, that are more used to eating raw food. You know, raw, they make it themselves. They're not exposed to ultra-processed foods generally because they probably haven't got the money. But look at the impact on the diet, you know, the diet when you change that.
Well, as I say, looking at that, a 2 week change can have significant impact.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so it really is. And, you know, it's the march of sort of ultra processed foods. I mean, they highlight things like French fries, but lots of things with additional sugars that are coming into this sort of Western diet as opposed to the typical diet for the area. So just another signpost, I think, for us all that ultra-processed foods need to start having a limited future, I guess.
They do, but we're addicted to them all, most societies. But once you stop eating ultra-processed foods, we hardly eat any ultra-processed foods now. We generally make it ourselves, and if we do buy anything, we're very careful to buy the least worst option. But once you get used to not having ultra-processed food, you feel so much better. That if you then start eating your McDonald's or something like that, you think, oh dear, you don't feel like you're getting any nutrition at all, to be honest.
No, I think and it's remarkable that there can be sort of physical changes in that 2-week changeover. So that's a very interesting article, and really from a bit from left field, I guess, in terms. A lot of the talk about diets. So I found that very interesting. I think the other thing I found interesting, because I'm getting to that sort of age now, is...
aren't we all, Paul?
Come on.
Sheffield University have received some funding and they're starting another study area on technical aids for people with dementia. So they're looking at developing new instruments, new things to give people the ability to make music, which is found to be very beneficial to a lot of people with dementia, but also sort of a wider study area. So not just looking at the effects to the person, but also how they can perhaps help to mitigate the changes that come with dementia. So interesting bit of study, locally, just to show that science is happening all over the world.
It is, yeah. It's just sometimes we don't know about it. Sheffield University and Sheffield Hallam University do some great research. It's whether or not, you know, we know about it.
We try to get across, I think, for a lot of the changes when we get to know about them. So hopefully we can help sort of get that message out there. And we have got a great educational establishment in Sheffield. So, and lots of students, I think we're sort of 70,000 plus students now. Very interesting. And different areas of research that we've touched upon show just the breadth of interest, and so it kind of brings me back to something I from my working days. I get a little publication now and again called Electronic Product Design and Test. They got articles in the last issue that they sent me. Talking about technology in farming and high-tech farms.
What did you? We just lost you then, Paul, slightly. What did you say that magazine was, or that journal?
Yeah, it's Electronic Design and Test, because I used to be involved with electronics and things.
Electronic Design and Test.
Yeah, and basically it's a series of articles about the inclusion of technology into agriculture and farming. So you kind of think, well, hang on, you know, farming's all rural and pastoral and, you know, lovely green fields and animals. What's the place of high-tech in farming? And it's massive, the sort of ways that high-tech's been produced to impact and increase yields within agriculture and to take on some of the tasks that people had to do at a low level. So I think initially one of the things that I saw is herds of cattle now are fitted with radio collars, and they go out in pasture and everything else. But when it comes to milking time, when they return to a milking parlour, the milking parlour can identify them from the radio collar. They're then addressed by the milking apparatus to know what that particular animal's history is and what works for it best to maximise getting the best amount of milk from a cow. But also it'll do things like on the way into the milking parlour, They have things like rotary brushes that go up and down the cow's back and give it a bit of a massage.
Oh, lovely.
Seems to make it a bit happier. And then they sort of march through, get a quick wash and rinse on the way out and back out to the fields. So where it used to be the farmer had to go and collect the cows, then it started to be something where they self-manage to some extent. But also the technology there is monitoring their milk yields and finding the things that work best for the individual animals. So it's kind of an interesting one to think about that. But then things like LED lighting. Increasingly, I remember many years ago, I went down to the south coast, just inland from Brighton, to a very large tomato growing company, and they were under glass, so it was a big, massive greenhouse, and they'd got the initial sort of bits of technical control. So they had temperature sensors, and the temperature sensors would address opening and closing the windows to vent air and keep the ideal temperature for the growing of tomatoes. There were lines strung above the tomato plants with misters, the sort of water things that turn not just a water jet, but a fine spray of mist. Again, they were controlled by a computer. There were sort of sensors within the soil to check the actual levels of moisture, and they were monitored and controlled. So a very much controlled environment, and I'm talking probably 30 years ago.
Yeah.
At least. So now what they're starting to do, quite funny, I think, I mentioned it a while ago when we were talking about Northern Lights, and in one area, people thought they'd got this sort of pinky-purple glow in the sky, and they thought it was a vestige of the Northern Lights, only to find out that they got one of these agricultural under-glass growing areas where they're now using LED lighting, which happens to have a pinky-purple colour when you see it from a distance. So that kind of move is underway. And also, you find in things like hydroponics, where essentially you grow plants in solution. And a lot of posh restaurants in inner cities now buy micro vegetables and micro herbs from that kind of a thing. And it can be grown in old sort of transport containers with controlled conditions really close to the inner city. So you can get these really fresh vegetables and herbs, very local, so you cut down the transport mileage that's necessary for them. And again, you've got computers monitoring and making more efficient the process of growing to get a good yield out. And it's very young and very fresh, so a great contribution. And then if you think about the farmer, they used to have ploughing competitions to make sure that they could plough in straight furrows to plough the fields. And that was all done by eye and the combination of man and beast originally, and then man and tractor. And now if you sit in the cab of some of the latest high-tech tractors, you've got a sat-nav system, and that can pick up the map of the field, and it can organise ploughing the field in the pattern that's necessary for whatever they want to grow. And it can do that across different fields, and I guess that we won't be too far from that becoming an automated driver rather than the farmer spending days in the cab doing his ploughing, which frees him off to do some more important things around as well. And again, once he's managed to get its field organised and planted, if it's something like grain, the same technology allows the harvesting to be better controlled. So again, satellite navigation keeps things like giant combine harvesters on track, making sure that they cut what they're supposed to cut. And then we've got sensors that can look at the condition of the crop, and that could be a sensor in a drone. So again, what's coming into farming now is things like drones, and they can see from the colour of the crop, whether it's green or whether if it's grain, it's becoming yellow and showing when it's ready to be harvested. And that used to be a job for the farmer to get up and walk around his fields and have a look.
Yeah. So, amazing.
Yeah, it's very good. And a lot of the hill farmers with sheep, guess what? A drone is very good for going out across the bleak uplands and picking out sheep that could be in trouble.
Wow.
It can also find them when they're trying to bring them in. And there's even been trials of robot dogs to control sheep.
Yeah, it's just a bit like Wallace and Gromit until something goes wrong. A switch is flicked or somebody's tampered with a switch and it all goes wrong.
Oh.
Amazing.
But there's just such a massive sort of look. I mean, they have nitrogen sensors that they can plant in the fields, and they will be connected back via the internet to the farm central, and they can work out things like whether they need extra fertilizer. They can also monitor the moisture in the soil, and again, that'll say, again, I don't know if you've been Lincolnshire, there used to be quite often on farms you'd see a spray system for crops. Surprisingly, I think in America, if you fly over the desert towards Las Vegas, there's a strange sight that you see these green circles in the desert. So nice sort of yellowy, deserty looking area. But then there are these brilliant patches of green vegetation. And what it is, there's a standpipe under the ground that comes up to a spray. That's got a wheel on the end that's fixed in the centre, so it creates a lovely, perfect circle of green growth in the desert.
Wow.
So you sort of look at that, and again, you can monitor the environment, keep the levels appropriate to whatever crop you're growing, and have a lot of feedback to be able to manage it to get the maximum out of agricultural land.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And you've chosen an amazing track, Paul. Go on.
Yeah, well, I thought sort of Bob Dylan and a little thing of a protest song that he did about working down on Maggie's farm.
Amazing. Great stuff, Paul. All being well, we'll speak to you Monday. Glory Days Rock Show. 1 till 3. Bye bye, Paul.
Bye bye.
Cheers. Bye.
I ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more. No, I ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more. Well, I wake up in the morning, hold my hands and pray for rain. I got a head full of ideas that are driving me insane. It's a shame the way she makes me scrub the floor. I ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more. I ain't gonna work for Maggie's brother no more. No, I ain't gonna work for Maggie's brother no more. Well, he hands you a nickel, he hands you a dime. He asks you with a grin if you're having a good time. And he finds you every time you slam the door. I cigar out in your face just for kicks. His bedroom window, it is made out of bricks. The National Guard stands around his door. I ain't gonna work for Maggie Pa no more.
A lovely track there, selected by PG, Maggie's Farm by Bob Dylan. I have to confess I've never heard that before, because we were talking about technology in farming, all interesting stuff. Of course, you listen to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We should have Phil Muffett on the line. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning. Hopefully you can hear me.
I can. Yes. Now you're under the stairs, I believe. The office under the stairs.
Harry Potter.
Yes.
I'm surprised you've not built yourself like an office somewhere else. Nearer the sky, for example.
Well, I built my office under the stairs. Well, I keep thinking about building another observatory for the back garden, but I keep talking myself out of it.
Or your wife keeps talking you out of it, more like.
Well, where do you stop? I don't know.
Well, indeed. Now, does anybody ever come down those stairs and jump on them to annoy you? Yeah. Oh, dogs started barking there.
Well, you did say it was one of those mornings.
It has been one of the mornings here in the studio, because it is live, but that's what makes it. So it's about to get better because we've got you on, Phil.
Thank you.
Have you had those T-shirts made yet? No.
Yeah.
I bet you haven't, have you?
Neither.
You know you could sell loads, couldn't you? So for people who don't know, you are a member of Mexman Swinton Astronomical Society. I was going to say an ex-president of, but have you ever been president of it?
Ex-presidents.
Have you ever been president of that society?
No.
Who is it?
I'm not old enough.
Are you not? Who's
Dr. Alan Chapman's our president.
Is
he? University.
History. Excellent.
And he's been on TV as well.
Oh.
He's absolutely top man. We've seen him down in Oxford. In fact, we've had a couple of guided tours at university. One of the privileges of being in a club is the fact that you can get into places that ordinary public can't get to.
Oh.
So I've been around the observatories and in the buildings and in the libraries and seen behind the curtains and all that kind of stuff.
Wow.
And in fact, the observatory in Oxford's also been on Lewis, you know, the detective. They did a crime scene inside the observatory and they kitted it all out with like astronomical gear, and it's nothing like that. In real life.
Well, yeah, get you. Yeah. Who knew, eh? Yeah, I never knew that you had a president so distinguished.
Yes, yeah.
Good stuff.
So tell us
about last week then and the eclipse.
Yeah. Well, it was really good, the eclipse. Fortunately, we had clear skies. It started about 10 o'clock and finished just after 12. So the maximum was about 11 o'clock. So it was really, really good. The clouds kept off. We had a couple of minutes where a big cloud came over near maximum. But that kind of happens on a regular basis. You do get weather patterns following eclipses across the sky.
And why is that? Because
it alters the temperature. So I don't know if you noticed, those people that actually observe the eclipse, as the moon started to move in front of the sun, the temperature altered. And the wind speed altered as well, because the wind picked up and it went as well. And it's because the sun's heating the ground, so it gives off thermals. When you cover half of the sun up, it alters the amount of heat that we're receiving. So it generates wind and it also generates different temperatures.
Wow.
So, and the other thing, if you get a total eclipse, it's amplified and you can see even more. And, of course, the birds think it's night time and go to sleep.
It's really strange.
It's a proper phenomenon. And I hope some people observed it safely as well. I got a new filter for the telescope. I've not got a bar filter, which like you can look at the sun with. And I had to turn all the settings down on the computer. Otherwise, the sun was just too bright. And you have to really, really finely focus it so you can pick the sunspots out. And there are a couple of really good sunspots on the sun to see as well. So, yeah, it was a tremendous success.
So how was your new filter? All you expected it to be?
Yes, it was really, really good. I think I only paid about £20 for it, £28 I think it was. I bought it online. I normally buy my stuff from Rother Valley Optics, but sometimes I've not got what you need. So I needed this light.
You needed it urgently.
So it came within about 5 days online.
Amazing.
And it was a reasonable price. So anyway, I checked it out to make sure it was safe.
But main thing is you got a clear sky, because often,
yes,
as you know, you're dependent on nature, aren't you, to have good viewing. That, so who got the best out of Maxwell Swinton Astronomical Society, and who got the best pictures?
Probably Mick.
Yeah.
Mick did some really good pictures. Mick Nichols, he got some lovely photos with his gear. But he's a really good hander. He's been doing it for years at taking solar images, so yeah. And we also had our member, Andy Devey, down in Spain. He did an animation and put it online. That was really good as well. So that was nice to see from a different country.
So where was the eclipse better, here or
Further north? Further north you went, the better it was.
Is that normally how it is, or just...
No, because it all depends where the ascending and descending nodes are on the ecliptic, and it also depends, are you on the right side of the planet? Because if you were around in Hawaii, you wouldn't have seen the eclipse. We were just on the right side. Like the lunar eclipse a couple of weeks ago, that was best seen from America because it happened later in the day, so it actually came into eclipse as it was setting in Europe, but it was coming into eclipse when it was in America. If you see what I'm saying.
So it
all depends on what time, where it is, all those factors kick in. So yeah, it's portal, really. Sometimes we get good things and sometimes we miss them.
That's how it is. So what else is there in the sky to look at after the excitement of the eclipse?
Well, the moon was really good a couple of nights ago. It passed in front of the Pleiades, which is a big star cluster. I managed to photograph that. Last night, I had the CCD camera out and I had it plugged into the telescope and the laptop. So I did some really big lunar images so I could see some really in-depth craters, which was really, really good. And I've also been using an EOS 350D and a 60D camera to try and do some some galaxies and some close-up cluster star formation. So the camera, it's a bit new to me. Well, I've done it before, but I'm trying to perfect it a bit better, and I've been like practicing different exposures and speeds and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's every day's a school day.
So you know, why is the moon been so good then the last few days?
Well, the thing is, the ecliptic is really high in the sky because the time of season is, and where the ecliptic is, it's really high. So the moon's really, really high in the sky. That's why Jupiter's really high, and there's also Mars. Now, if you're looking at the moon tonight, it's about first quarter, which looks like half a moon. It's just above Mars and just below Pollux and Castor, which are the two stars, the twin stars in Gemini. So you'll get all three two stars, the moon and the planet all in a line underneath through Gemini. So that'll be worth watching out for tonight. And once you've found Mars, which is a really, really bright looking star, actually a planet, if you follow it night from week to week, it's moving underneath the actual twins. So you can actually physically see how it's moving each night.
Wow.
So it's been moving westward, now it's moving eastwards because we've kind of passed it in the sky. It's a bit like that I explained the other week, where you're running around a track and we're on the inside track and Mars is on the outside track and we're overtaking it on the bend.
Yes.
So you can see it kind of slow. It looks as though it's slowing up, so it kind of moves retrograde, which is like backwards in the sky. So it's good at the moment. So Orion's starting to disappear in the evening. Because we've lost the hour, the evenings are drawing out a bit, so you're getting the... I'm now going out later. I can have my tea at a reasonable time now. And then get my gear out and then do a bit of observing. Whereas last month it was a bit tricky because it was all around tea time. But it's getting better now.
Trouble is, as the year goes on and it gets darker later and later, you're stopping up later and later, I guess.
That's right, yes. So, yeah. And the other thing is there's some really interesting galaxies coming around. So Leo's started to get high in the sky. So the other night I was trying to photograph the Leo triplet, which is three galaxies underneath Leo, which is M56, 55, and the Hamburger galaxy. So they're like closely together. And there's also an asteroid quite close by. Managed to photograph that. It's right on the threshold of my visibility. And I picked it up on the camera quite easily. And then the other night, I also photographed the quartet in Leo, which is four galaxies in the neck of Leo. And unbeknown to me, I actually photographed an asteroid as well. I didn't find out while the following day, when I was checking what I'd actually photographed, this asteroid popped up on Stellarium. And I thought, well, I wonder if I got that. So I've been back and had a look at my photos, and I've actually captured a 12th magnitude asteroid.
Wow.
Called Galia, which is 148th on the list. So I've ticked two. In the past 2 nights.
It's ticking off things. So you're photographing a lot of stuff now, though, aren't you?
Well, I'm trying to. I've been photographing using the iPhone. Now, the iPhone's not bad at doing photos, but when you start looking at galaxies, it's getting a bit tricky. I've downloaded some different programs to try and take better pictures, but I've got to a spot where I'm struggling to get it any better. So I thought I'll try the camera and see how.
So that you said that's pictures. A CCD camera.
Yeah.
What's that again?
Charge couple device. The chip that's in your iPhone.
Yeah.
Well, they're a version of that but bigger. And it's the same in your digital cameras, you know, your DSLR cameras. They've got a chip just the same as in your phone, but a lot bigger. So the fact that it's a lot bigger, you can get a bigger area of sky and you can get some more resolution and better depth. So it's just a different way of technology. It's just a different way of doing it.
So you are doing more photography, though. Is that because you're more interested in that, or is it to capture and prove that you've seen things?
Well, it's good to be able to capture stuff and put it online. So I'm just trying to like do better photography, so you can like put across what you can see better. So the iPhone's really easy to do a snap. Whereas the DSLRs and CCDs that you can plug into your laptop, you can do more technical stuff, like you can like alter the color balances better, and you can like draw stuff out, and you can get rid of like noise in the background easier. So it's just on the, if you can download it onto a laptop using bigger chips, you've got more flexibility on what you can do and how you can do it.
So have you got a list of things that you want to see this year that you tick off? Is it a bucket list for like your whole life, or does it change year on year?
Well, it's kind of a bit of a journey. So, I've done general astronomy for a lot of years, so I've seen a lot of things I wanted to see, including Aurora. But now I've got my own better telescope and a better setup in my own garden. I can actually do some work on my own for myself to just try and hone my skills, as it were.
And you probably can see things better now you've got the equipment you've got. So you're going to have to go and tick it all off again then.
Yeah, yes. So asteroids, I started observing last year. It's not something I've bothered with before. But one of the things about asteroids and comets is they're really dynamic and they're moving around and they come and go, and it's kind of these one-off events that you see, whereas your constellations and your galaxies are quite static.
Yes.
So they're there year after year, but your comets and your asteroids are more tricky to find because they're moving from night to night.
Yes.
So it's just a bit more of a challenge. Now I've got a movable telescope, better equipment, better resolution, better cameras. I'm starting to get do expand my search.
And it's warmer, I guess, relatively speaking.
Well, yes, although last night, got about 10 o'clock, half past 10, and I was getting cold. So I'll draw a line under it. Tuesday and Wednesday was really good. I think Wednesday it was a really nice night. But last night, trying to photograph the moon, you could just see how turbulent the atmosphere was. And it was probably later in the evening it started to settle down. The problem is, if you look at things under high magnification, you pick up the distortions in the atmosphere a lot more.
By that, do you mean because it's been windy?
No, it's a heat. It's a heat in the atmosphere. So the air is like water. So if you heat water, it starts to bubble and you can't see through it as well. And the atmosphere is the same. It distorts the light coming through the atmosphere.
So that's because it's been warm, because it was very warm yesterday, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. And it took a long time to go. That's why in the morning, the atmosphere, when you look at the stars and first thing in the morning, if you get up early and the stars are up, they're really, really steady and really, really, how can I put it, fresh.
Yes.
In the evening, the atmosphere is more turbulent. Have a look at the sky. If you see things twinkling and moving about, you know, it's because it's hot and the atmosphere is moving. So, evening astronomy can have its problems. However, you know, it's something. It depends what you're trying to photograph.
Yeah.
And what you're looking at.
It's interesting because during COVID, which seems, well, it's 5 years now. So, you talked about the difference in the sky because people weren't flying. And
yes.
And
the
you said it
was cleaner.
Yeah.
Definitely. The sun was whiter because there was less pollution of the light to get through. So the pollution in the atmosphere distorts the colour of the sun.
Yeah.
And it also distorts everything else as well. So all these planes and cars going around, it do produce pollution. And we don't notice it like we used to, because it's a lot cleaner.
It is. It's not black smog, is it, like from the coals, burning coal or whatever?
Yeah, that's right. So it does make a difference. It does make a difference without a shadow of a doubt.
But obviously back then you didn't have the equipment you've got now, personally, did you?
That's right. Well, yeah, that's right. So, back in the 1980s, I had a Zenit TTL, which was a really good film camera. I think it was Russian, I used to use Fujifilm 400. Use £5 for a film roll and get it developed, and you might have a couple of decent photographs. Now, with a DSLR camera, I've got the old one I've got, the 350D. I'll do a speed of 1600. You couldn't buy 1600 films back in 1980.
No.
And the last EOS we've got is the 60D. That'll go to 64 ISO, which is really, really, really high. So I can do a photograph in like 2 seconds, whereas back in 1980, it was, I couldn't look at the photograph once I'd taken it until it had it developed.
I know.
You might have to have it exposed for about 4 minutes.
Yeah.
So you got things would drift, or you'd
have
to
focus.
It'd be out of focus, and you might get a decent, so you'd have to do all kinds of alterations. With the Canon, the latest Canon we've got, I can do a live view, zoom in on a star, focus it, and then zoom back out, and then do a 2 or 3, 4 second exposure. And I've got I've got stars down to 15th magnitude. I can only barely see down to 10 with my naked eye in the telescope. With film, I can get down to 15, 14, 15.
Do you know the sad thing is, Phil, there'll be some people listening who won't even know what a film roll is. I do.
And slides.
It's but in some technology. But I'm going to have to let you go now, Phil. I can't believe it. We could speak for hours.
Yeah,
fantastic stuff, as always. We're going to play.
Have a nice month.
Yes, indeed. Have a nice rest, Phil. Have a big full breakfast now.
Yeah, I'm off to America.
Are you?
For a fortnight. Yeah.
Are you? Oh, look at you. I shall watch out for the photographs.
North Carolina. I don't know if there's anything astronomical there, but I'll
you'll find it if it is. Brilliant. Enjoy, Phil. Bye-bye.
See you next month.
Bye.